This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello everyone, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Joan Schweigert about Gifts for the Dead, the second novel in her Rivers trilogy. When I interviewed Joan back in 2016, she had just republished The Last Wife of Attila the Hun, initially called Gudrun's Tapestry. The Rivers trilogy is set a good 1,500 years later and in a different hemisphere. Gifts for the Dead, for example, opens in Hoboken, New Jersey in 1911. We were to expect a knock on the door, Clementine said, any day now. In her vision, she saw Maggie, who would be the one to answer it, squinting into the faces of the visitors, two of them, big boys from down on the docks. The squinting details suggested it were early morning, with the sun just coming up over the Hudson. The boys would explain they'd come to confirm they'd had good word from their shipping cohorts that both Maggie's sons, Jack and Baxter Hopper, had perished in the South American rainforest where they'd gone 2 years earlier to make their fortune tapping rubber trees. This was not a shock to us. Clementine had been warning us for some time that things had gone obliquo for Baxter and Jack. The fact that we'd had no word from them in ages did not encourage us either. Furthermore, the newspapers were full of horror stories of men who'd gone to tap for rubber, only to lose their lives in unimaginable ways. Nevertheless, we prayed, even though not one of us was a churchgoer. We all believed in higher power, and we all prayed all the time that just once Clementine was wrong. And now, please join me in welcoming Joan Schweigert. Hi, Joan. I look forward to talking with you today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
We discussed your path to becoming a writer in our earlier interview, which listeners can hear by searching for your name on the New Books Network. So let's go straight to the current series. What drew you away from the world of Attila and Gudrun toward the Amazon River Valley in 1910?
Okay, well, I was hired by, I'm a freelance writer as well as writing novels and so forth, and I was hired by a small publishing company to kind of speed read their backlist books and write a description for their website. And one of the books that I read was an actual diary written by a rubber tapper. I think it's probably the only one in existence from back in 1910 in South America. And I fell in love with the information. I knew nothing about the rubber boom before, and it just really intrigued me. And at about the same time, I learned about an organization of environmentalists and sustainability advocates who were taking people into the jungle to learn about the jungle, but also to meet indigenous tribal people and understand what their challenges were. And so I went, and by the time I came out, I was totally hooked on all things having to do with the rainforest in South America, and I decided that I wanted to write my own book about rubber tappers in South America, and it turned into three books.
Now, Gifts for the Dead is actually the second book, although it's the one that came out just last fall. So what do we need to know about Rivers 1 in order to understand this story?
Basically, you only need to know that there are, the story starts with, in book one, with two Irish-American brothers, Jack and Baxter Hopper, who are dock workers from Hoboken, New Jersey, and they give up their jobs and travel to the Amazon rainforest in 1908 to become rubber tappers, and only one returns.
As you just mentioned, book one also started in Hoboken, but it moved straight away to the Amazon River, specifically Manaus in Brazil and the countryside around it. In Gifts, we spend a large part of the book in New Jersey. So tell us, why Hoboken? What was going on there in 1908 and 1910 and in 1911 that made it the perfect setting for these books?
Well, my choice was more about its location. I wanted to have a place for the brothers to be from and their family, their mother and father, and everybody else who winds up in the books. That would have train stations, that would have shipyards, since they're dock workers, they especially needed shipyards. And Hoboken was smaller and manageable from a research point of view. And as I began to learn things about the history of Hoboken, I saw that it was a really good fit for the background for Gifts for the Dead, especially because Hoboken played a large part in World War I.
The first person we meet in this novel is Nora Sweeney. She's the character who tells her own stories. So who is she at the point when we meet her? What history does she carry into this book?
Well, the one thing that Nora would think of to identify herself that stays with her all the time is the fact that she's an orphan. Both of her parents die of consumption in New York City when she's 4 years old, and she's raised by her Aunt Becky, who lives in Hoboken. So that's how she gets to know Jack and Baxter. She's part of their gang kind of as a child. And we see her in a lot of flashbacks in book one, all the time that she spends with the two brothers. And as the two brothers get older, they're both in love with her. So there she is already for book two.
And how would you describe her as a personality?
She is very political. Her Aunt Becky is a very political person. And when Aunt Becky has no maternal skills, she doesn't really know how to take care of a child. But she knows enough not to leave her alone when she goes to her political meeting. So she drags Nora along with her, and Nora learns to become very political too. And she's very much, an advocate for women's rights, especially.
And Jack, although his tale is told in the third person, is in many ways as important to the novel as Nora. Fill us in, not just on those parts of his past that we need to understand, but his personality as it develops over the course of this book.
Okay, well, there's a really significant shift in his personality from book one to book two. In book one, he's still a teenager, and he goes off with his brother to the Amazon, and he's always in competition with his brother. And Baxter, who's older, he's got a louder mouth, he's a bit brash, he's an instigator, and Jack really tries to keep up with him. So in some sense, Baxter brings out the worst in Jack. And then the jungle changes both of them, and it changes Jack especially in that he almost dies. And when he comes back from the jungle, he's very, very ill, and that's how book two opens, with his return from the jungle and his very long illness.
He's quite a bit different in personality from Nora as well, don't you think?
Yes. Where she's political, he's almost apolitical. He's very caring. He's very sensitive to the people around him, but he just doesn't show it the same way that she does. And he's quieter. When he comes back from the jungle and finally recovers his health, he's a quiet man. Who keeps a lot to himself.
And she's very much the opposite.
Yes. Yeah, she says whatever happens to be on her mind.
She's absolutely adorable, I have to say.
Oh, good.
So another character is Maggie, who is Jack's mother, but she's also in a sense Nora's mother. So tell us how that came about, who Maggie is, and about Nora's relationship with her.
Well, Maggie immigrated from Ireland in her 20s, and both of her sons were born in Hoboken. She's an uncomplicated woman who loves her family, first and foremost. Nora, on the other hand, is raised by an aunt who, as you know, I said, Aunt Becky is interested in making sure that Nora does well in school and has a very good understanding of her civic duties, but she doesn't have any maternal instincts. So Nora gravitates to Maggie, Jack and Baxter's mother, and really becomes part of the family. There's some tender moments between them because Maggie is the kind of woman who wouldn't burden her sons with the stories about the hardships that she endured when she was in Ireland and first coming to America. And Jack and Bax aren't the kind of boys, when they're young at least, who would sit and listen to those stories anyway. So Nora, who's starved for stories, having been an orphan for so many years, gravitates to Maggie and Maggie to her, and they wind up with a very special relationship.
And this situation that you sketch in the beginning of where the two boys go to the jungle and only one of them comes back, I mean, that's especially hard. It's hard on Nora, it's hard on Jack, but it's especially hard on Maggie, I think.
Yes. Yes, Maggie. And Maggie, before, in the beginning of book one, or actually it's before, it happens before the beginning of book one, before we died. She loses her husband, too, in an apartment building fire. So she's already, besides the hardships coming from Ireland, besides the loss of her husband, now when Jack comes back alone and the belief is that Baxter is dead, she has another hardship to endure.
So we can't leave out Clementine because she's such a wonderful character, really vivid and on the page. Tell us about her and her place in these books.
Well, in book one, she is hired by Maggie. She's a fortune teller. She's an Italian fortune teller from the Italian part of Hoboken, which was another really nice thing about Hoboken. There were three immigrant communities in Hoboken at the time that I'm writing about, German, Italian, and Irish. So, they all had their own sections in town, and it just made it more colorful to be writing about these various characters. But Clementine is an Italian, and she works with Maggie to communicate with Baxter Sr., her husband, after he dies. And Baxter Sr. is actually the one that says to Clementine that he feels that the boys should have some kind of an adventure or something to distract them, because they're so miserable after his death, they just can't get over it. And that kind of sets everything going for them to go up to the jungle. But Maggie and Clementine, in the meantime, become very, very close. And at the beginning of book two, Gifts for the Dead, Clementine makes a prediction that Maggie's going to get, she hasn't heard from her sons for a really long time, and there are all these articles in the newspaper about all the people who are dying in the jungle, tapping rubber trees, and Clementine predicts that Maggie's going to get some bad news very soon about her sons, that there's going to be a knock at the door, and she predicts it'll be in the morning because she knows where the sun is on the Hudson River at the time the door opens, and she gets this bad news. And so the three of them, Maggie and Nora and Clementine, begin sitting together every morning waiting for that knock to come. And that's how the story opens.
We won't say exactly where this second incident I'm about to ask you about comes in, because it's fairly far into the story. But Clementine is not the only fortune teller in this novel, and I'm curious as to why you included that element.
Isabella. Yes, Isabella is the... Jack comes back from the jungle with secrets, mostly having to do with his brother. But there are a lot of things in the jungle that he doesn't talk to anybody else about. And he kind of gets off the hook easily because he's so sick when he comes back that everybody's afraid to talk to him too much about the jungle for fear that he'll start having flashbacks and, you know, that psychologically he'll go back into the kind of stupor that he was in when he first came back. So at some point, though, he feels the need to tell somebody about the things that are going on in his head, and he goes to a fortune teller, and her name is Isabella, and that's where she comes in. And he doesn't want his cards read. She's a tarot reader, and what he does not want is to have his cards read. He's very much against that. He can't understand how anybody could think a bunch of cards that look like playing cards to him could give you any information. But Isabella tells him plenty without cards.
So she's kind of like a therapist for him, in a sense, that she's someone who listens?
she listens, and she also tells him, you know, that the secrets that he's keeping are going to hurt him in the end. They're going to destroy his relationship with Nora. And I should mention that when he comes back from the jungle and Bax doesn't come back, Nora had been engaged to Bax. So in book one, that's the person that you might conclude she's going to wind up with. But Bax doesn't come back. And eventually time passes and she and Jack begin to have a relationship. And their relationship is always challenged by the elephant in the room, which is Bax, because there are a lot of things that Jack isn't talking about having to do with his brother. So that's what he talks to Isabella about.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but you just answered the question. So unlike Before We Died, which is pretty much confined to the period between 1908 and 1910, this book goes from 1911 all the way up to 1928. We'll go over some of the specifics in a second, but what made you decide to approach this novel differently and attack a longer time span?
Well, I wanted it to cover the end of the rubber boom, which is like 1911-12, to the beginning of Henry Ford coming into historically to create a rubber plantation, Fordlandia, in Brazil. So I wanted to keep those two things on either end, and that necessitated, you know, having a bigger span of time. I didn't want how much time I was going to give to this middle book to be a result of, you know, trying to make it symmetrical with the other two, the other books on the other end.
No, I didn't think that that was a problem in itself. I was just curious that it was a different approach, in part, I suppose, because it's so much a novel of relationships, especially Jack and Nora's relationship.
Right, exactly.
So as the novel opens, it's already a pretty dramatic period, especially politically. And as you mentioned, Nora is very politically involved. And in particular, she's involved in the women's suffrage movement. So how does she get caught up in this?
Well, again, it's from her Aunt Becky. She's just learned to speak her mind and to be kind of on the lookout for things that need attention. And certainly women's rights at that time needed some attention. She makes her first political speech on behalf of women's rights in the schoolyard, and she gets in trouble for doing so. And in the book, though, we see her at various times speaking out. When World War One breaks out, she speaks out for that. What she speaks out for is everyone's right to express their own opinions about it, because there was a lot of propaganda going on and people were getting beat up for not sharing the same opinions as the people who thought we should be in the war. So she's not necessarily for or against, but she's for our right to people's rights to speak out. But she's very political.
And Jack's not entirely comfortable with this.
No, in fact, there's one instance where it becomes mandatory at some point that everybody get a draft card, that they register for the draft. And she tells Jack that she doesn't want him to register because she's against that. And they have an argument where, you know, the elephant in the room actually bears his head. And he says that he's going to. And the reason why is because it's what his brother would have done. So
next we have World War One, which had a major impact on Hoboken. Why was that, and how did it have that impact?
Well, there was a shipyard in Hoboken, and almost all of the ships were German-owned. Baxter and Jack's father worked for a German-owned shipyard. Baxter and Jack worked for another German-owned shipyard. And when the war broke out, Woodrow Wilson commanded the U.S. Army to take over the shipyards and to arrest the German owners who wouldn't kind of just go away on their own, and refurbished the ships so that the doughboys could use them from all over the country to go to Europe to fight in the war. So there were soldiers all over Shipyard. It completely changed the little town of Hoboken. In fact, they had a saying, heaven, hell, or Hoboken by Christmas, the doughboys who were going off because they hoped to be back by Christmas. And there was also a growing mistrust of one-third of the immigrant community in Hoboken because they were German-Americans. So there was a lot going on. A lot of people think because World War I was fought in Europe that, and we got in at the very end and we got out quickly, that there wasn't a lot going on in this country, but there was. And it all happened in Hoboken.
And in fact, I think from the little I understand, because this is not really my period, in some ways it was more difficult for the German community in World War I, although the U.S. involvement was shorter, because it was, you know, the first time. And so here were a group of people who had actually been in pretty good under pretty good conditions, and all of a sudden they're the enemy.
Exactly. It was really kind of horrifying. Schools weren't allowed to teach anything about Germany anymore. German churches were closing. All kinds of things were happening. But in Hoboken, because they had ships going out to Europe, they were especially afraid of sabotage by the Germans. And so they actually had people who lived within a half a mile of the shipyard who were German had to vacate their, you know, residence and go, you know, just leave town, which made it really, really hard for a lot of people. They had no place to go.
Well, as you mentioned, Jack was a dock worker at the beginning of Before We Died, but the events in that novel have affected him in ways that they've affected his health, as we also mentioned. And as a result, he has to find a new line of work. So how do he and Nora support themselves and his mother during the war?
Well, when Jack comes back, he wants to go right back to the docks, but by the time that he recovers, he's still really weak and he can't go back to the docks. Even though that he's a sensitive guy and he reads, which his brother didn't read, but he also likes that all the men in his family were dock workers. They all use their bodies, their brawn. And so when he can't do that anymore, he decides to go to, across the river to Lipton Tea. Lipton Tea has a company there, the Lipton Tea Factory, and he goes there and becomes a manager, and makes decent money.
And Nora works at a bookshop, right?
Yes, and Nora has a part-time job working for the bookshop.
Why Thomas Lipton? How does he get into your story?
Well, I decided that Jack had to work somewhere, and I knew that Lipton Tea, actually, there was a fire there, and they wound up moving to Hoboken, and the building that they had in Hoboken is now luxury condos. But I knew it was there, and I thought, well, I'm going to work this into the book so that that's where Jack can work when he, you know, stops working in Manhattan and comes back and works in Hoboken. And so in order to research, I read a book by Michael D'Antonio, yeah, and it's called The Full Cup, and it's all about Thomas Lipton, and it was so fascinating. Thomas Lipton was a really big celebrity, mostly because of, he was always in the World Cup for sailing, but everybody loved him. He was really well known in that time period, and now nobody knows that anymore. And I just thought, wow, he's great. So I actually had a fictionalized Thomas Lipton show up in the book. And so it was great fun.
Yeah, I had no idea he was involved in the World Cup or so deeply involved in yachting. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, he came over from, he was living in Scotland at the time, and he was doing all kinds of great things there, opening grocery stores and giving jobs to people. And then he started coming over here for the World Cup because he loved sailing and competing. And he just, decided that he would open a Lipton Tea company here, and he became very popular very quickly. everybody loved him. Everybody knew him and everybody loved him in that time period. So Jack actually gets to meet him when he goes to apply for his job.
The end of the war in 1918 coincided with a major and very deadly influenza epidemic. How does that affect Jack and Nora?
The family doctor, when Jack first comes back from the rainforest, the family doctor thinks that the disease, the diseases that he's suffering from are very similar. He doesn't think this when he first comes back, but when the flu breaks out, the Spanish flu, he thinks that Jack is immune to it because of the diseases that he had in the jungle. He sees a lot of similarities. And Jack kind of takes him at his word. So, you know, when it happens really fast. So all of a sudden, you know, the flu moves into Hoboken and schools are closed and all businesses closed. Everything closes up because it's so highly contagious. And Jack thinks that he's not going to get it because of his diseases when he came back from the jungle. So he actually volunteers to go out and do the things that have to be done. And one of them is digging holes so that firefighters can take bodies because the bodies are accumulating and there's no room for them in morgues or funeral homes and bury them. And the other thing that Jack does is he goes into the hospital, actually the hospital annex, and reads to children who are probably dying. That particular flu killed more young people, not necessarily young children, but teenagers, young people, than older people or very young people. And so the hospital ward where he volunteers is full of young teenagers, and he finds that that's something that he really enjoys doing, is just reading to these young kids who are dying.
So how did you research all these events, especially in the context of Hoboken?
Well, I really lucked out. Hoboken has a historical museum, and during the time that I was researching everything Hoboken, they were doing their centennial by having all these historians come in and give presentations on various aspects of the war in Hoboken, the Spanish flu in Hoboken, all the things that I wanted to know about, and they were all filmed and archived, and I watched every one of them. So I was reading books all the time too while I was researching everything, but I got to sit and watch all these great videos about exactly the time period that I was writing about. So
wow, that really was a stroke of good luck.
I know. It really was. It was incredible. I couldn't believe it. And I had already chosen Hoboken to be the place that, you know, that my Irish contingent was going to be from before I knew about these archives. So I felt very fortunate.
Absolutely. So eventually, Jack and Nora do return to the Amazon River Valley. And I think we probably don't want to say too much about what they find there because it's late in the book. But can you give us a sense of the conditions of the rubber industry more generally, both during Jack's first trip and his second, and how those contrast or don't?
Well, it didn't really start suddenly. I think the rubber boom started around, 1875 in South America. But by the early 1900s, it was really going strong, and Manaus wound up being the hub of the rubber boom because of its location. It was the one place that you could get to on the Amazon River that was deep enough that big ships could arrive to take out the haul of rubber. So, and beyond that, the ships couldn't go anywhere, so into the interior. So it went from being a sleepy fishing village to filling up with all these Europeans, and they rebuilt it more or less in their own image. They built floating docks to handle the rubber. They built mansions to live in. Entrepreneurs came and built restaurants, and there was just all this opulence flying around. And at the center of it all was the Opera House, which is still really famous today because it's on top of a hill and it's got a golden dome, and the roof tiles came from France and chandeliers came from Italy, and things were imported from all over Europe. And, in the hope that that opera singers, opera stars from all around the world would come. And so then the rubber boom ended and everything was abandoned. So when Jack and Nora returned, well, Jack is returning and Nora is going for the first time to Manaus, what they find is a city of poor people because everybody fled. All the wealthy people fled when there was no more rubber money to be made. So it's completely changed. Buildings are, mold is growing all over buildings. Trees are growing out of windows. The jungle is taking over again. Very different.
What would you like readers to take away from Gifts for the Dead?
Well, I want everybody to enjoy the story and to feel like they're entertained. But I'm really interested in saying something, you know, and I don't say anything, I don't preach anything, but I'm really interested in drawing people's attention to the Amazon. If you read all three books, of course, the third one's not quite done, but the three books together collectively talk about threats to the Amazon, and everything, and always something happened to keep the threats from destroying the Amazon. And in 1910, the reason why the rubber boom ended so suddenly is because years earlier, this British guy stole a bunch of rubber seeds and brought them back to England, and they were later, they later began to grow on plantations. So the rubber boom ended and the Amazon was safe again. And then in the 1930s or late 1920s, Ford came along, Henry Ford, and he tried to start a plantation, and that didn't go anywhere because you cannot have a rubber plantation in South America because of a leaf blight problem. Now the Amazon doesn't seem to have anything that's going to save it. It's deforestation, mining, logging. There's the big displacement of indigenous people. I just read an article this morning that 30% of all the murders in Brazil last year were indigenous people. They were miners and loggers who were murdering indigenous people who the government is no longer standing up for because there's a new government in place, and it's really interested in making the Amazon turn into a money pool. That's the one thing I hope that people will start paying attention to is what's going on in the Amazon.
Yeah, that is very disheartening if you think, I mean, your first story is more than 110 years ago, and yet here we are, and the treatment of the indigenous peoples is not much better than it was then.
No, yeah, you're right. Probably a lot worse.
You're now working on the last book in your trilogy, River Aria. What can you tell us about that novel?
Well, I can't really say too much without telling you how Gifts for the Dead ends, but the opera house in Manaus that I mentioned plays a part in book three, a big part. So kind of just leave it there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Joan Schweigert about Gifts for the Dead, the second book in her Rivers trilogy. Find out more about her at www.joanschweigert.com. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creative community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/nbn/join. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.